Okay, good evening, Erev Tov. Firstly, welcome back to Jerry, who's... I thought I recognized you when I came in. I wasn't quite sure if it was you, but you come back from Florida with a suntan in the winter, so that's always a good sign. Well, it's good, you know. You come like Glila. You get all the zechut for the whole semester. So I'm excited about that. Next week is the last week. This week and next week, Mitzvah Hashem, and we'll see. It may be continued here. I mean, we'll have to talk to Larry in the fall. It may be possible. I'm thinking very. What's the word? Laterally about it. In other words, you know, it is a possibility, and we need to talk about it. Do Yeshayo? I'm keen on doing one of the heavy prophets, but not Jeremiah, which is so depressing. I just don't know. I don't want to get too depressed. Monday night, it's the beginning of the week. You don't want to end up, you know, being down for the whole week. Yeshayo has got a lot of very uplifting stuff, and Yechezkel is more challenging because there's a lot of stuff there which. You know, Yeshayo, we can sort of get a handle on Yechezkel. I'm not sure if you can try, you know. I mean, it's certainly, potentially, it'll be one or the other. It'll be between the two. But that's the possibility for the fall. But as I said, you know, there's plenty of time to discuss it. And Mirtz Hashem, we should all be well and gazun. That's more important. For today, what we're going to do, as I said last week, I was very devious in the sense that I sort of chapter around chapter 11. We spent time talking about Perek Yud, and Perek Yud Aleph, as I said, is really essentially the names of the people who were living in Yerushalayim. And again, I'm not going to go just read through the names, just to tell you what it's about. And even the half of Perek Yud Bet, in other words, chapter 11, the names of the people living in Yerushalayim. Chapter 12 is the beginning, is the names going back to the listings which we've got used to of the Levim, of the watches, the Mishmarot. The Malbim puts it very interestingly. He says that there are in fact three different listings to be found. There's a listing of names of this particular listing. One is in Divrei Yomim, one's in Sefer Ezra, one's in Sefer Nehemiah. And the Malbim argues that each Sefer is a completion of the previous Sefer. In other words, basically what he's saying is that Divrei Yomim was written essentially by Ezra. It was completed, as far as Malbim is concerned, with Sefer Ezra. He carried on writing. And Sefer Ezra is then completed with the sort of, I suppose you would call it the footnote, if you want to call it that, with Sefer Nehemiah. All of those three Sephorim have within them this listing of various groups, people who came back from the Galut, the Mishmarot, the that we're going to see here in chapter 12, and also the listings of the, not just the Levim, but the general listing of the people for different purposes. And it's all very significant, and the Malbim spends a lot of time, which I said I'm not going to go into, but I'm referring you to him, of the differences. There's a lot of overlap. And there is also a lot of places where certain names are left out. For instance, here Nehemiah leaves out names which Ezra mentioned in his Sefer. Because essentially what's going on here in chapter 12 is that Nehemiah is going back to the old listing. He came a bit later. But the fact is, he's going back to the original listing of people who came back. The Levium, as you remember, wasn't a big turnout of Levium. And that was part of Ezra's problem. We spoke about that last week. And Ezra basically made a very serious halakha. He made a very serious takana. Ezra was very good at making Jewish law sort of, you know, applicable in these circumstances. And Levium were penalized for not coming back. Right? There was a lot of issues with the Levium at the beginning. And here again, they're trying to record for posterity. Oh, good evening. My goodness. Okay, we're being invaded by Florida. I wish you'd bring some heat. It's cold. It's really cold. yeah. All right, next week. I suppose next week. Anyway, so just to continue the particular thought, the names which are being brought in, again, there are discrepancies, and of course that will be something to look into through the commentary of the Malbim. So I'm not, as I said, I'm not going to go through that, but where we're going to take up the story is in the middle of chapter 12. Because after we get the listings of chapter 12, we will get this fantastic description of the dedication of the walls of Yerushalayim. What happens is that the Chemya is, as I said, all the way through, a man of great emunah. He's a man who, you know, he's got a lot of qualities about him, which I feel make him a bit more approachable than Ezra. Ezra was Ezra Sofer. Ezra was the great scholarly figure, as I compared him to Moshe Rabbeinu. He was the guy who was, you know, sort of out there, putting together the text of the Torah. You know, there's a lot of things that we know about Ezra that in his day, things were beginning to become formalized, if that's the way to describe it. When you get to the story of Nehemiah, who essentially was contemporary, but carried on the more day-to-day stuff, you read about Nehemiah being much more concerned with Am Yisrael in their everyday challenges and their everyday behaviors. And of course, one of the issues that goes right through this Sefer Nehemiah is the problem of mixed marriages, the intermarriage, which they brought their non-Jewish wives to Eretz Yisrael, and how Ezra dealt with that. Now we're going to see Nehemiah is going to have a similar approach. But there are other things that Nehemiah is going to deal with, which we'll start talking about today. Mitzvah Shem, next week, we finish chapter 13, there's a little bit that I want to talk about from the Gemara Shabbos. Gemara Shabbos in page 122. Kuf Chaf Bet, and it's actually on Kuf Chaf Gimel, there's a little section of Gemara which talks about Nehemiah. And the Gemara there tells us exactly what Nehemiah did to preserve the laws of Shabbos. And it's very interesting. It's not the way we would go about it. All right, you know, it's a very different approach. Whether you like Nehemiah's approach or you won't like Nehemiah's approach, we'll have to see when we get there. So that will be kind of a nice way to finish off the Sefer, which Mitzvah Shem, we hope will happen next week. So what I want to do today, and we'll start probably get into a little bit of chapter 13 as well, is to look at Sefer Nehemiah chapter 12, and we're going to take it from verse 27, Pasuk Kaf Zayin. I don't know what page that is in your... 204, page 204. Before you get to verse 27, as I said, there is this listing of the various watches, the various mishmarot, discrepancies between this list and other lists, and that's something, as I said, that you can look into in your own time. But have a look at this, Kaf Zayin. Ubechanukat Chomad Yerushalayim. Now they've got to make a dedication of the walls of Yerushalayim. Okay, and again, this is something which is very special. If you've ever had the experience of attending in Jerusalem, anything which happens, that area which is down in the valley there, which they show, they do this, almost project, use the walls like a projector screen. I've forgotten what that area is called. The valley, is it Kidron? Is that Kidron area? Well, yeah, what is it called there? They do fantastic kind of presentations there, you know, events, particularly now, this time, if you go between Pesach and Shavuos, there's some wonderful spring events that go on there. And the walls of Jerusalem, just sort of, you know, they become so unique. I mean, we you know, Chomod Yerushalayim for us is as precious as sort of, you know, the rest of Jerusalem. I suppose it's sort of the protector of Jerusalem. These are the Shomrei HaChomot, right? We talk about the guardians of the walls, right? And we see the walls as protecting Yerushalayim. Obviously, I mean, I'm saying obvious things, but the fact is that this becomes an extension I'm going to use the Hebrew, chotemet. This is a stamp, a shtempel of the permanence and the strength of Yerushalayim. And of course, all the churbanot are revolving around destruction of the walls. The first thing that goes in terms of either siege of the walls of Jerusalem or a breach of the walls of Jerusalem. You know, the Chomod Yerushalayim, they've got a life of their own. Which is again very fascinating, because you'll see here one of the big celebrations of Nehemiah, and again this must have been a popular celebration, is to celebrate the dedication of the walls of Yerushalayim. Almost to the point where we haven't seen this type of celebration before in described in this way. Yeah. It's not the same. You have to read. Well, let's put it this way, that there are different layers. It's a bit like what goes on at the Kotel. You know, when you stand at the Kotel, you've got these grates, and you look down, great G-R-A-T-E, right? And you look down, and you see how far down it goes. And there are different levels of wall according to different periods in Jewish in history, not Jewish history, regular history, there are books written about it. You know, you probably got a Wikipedia article about it, telling you all the different. I know Salah ad-Din, there's a level where in the 11th century that he added to that particular wall. Right, and then after that, there were. It was finished off because it's very leveled off. It's not a wall which has been around for 2,000 years without some sort of what's the word? Shiputzim, renovations. That's the word, and various other things like that. So it is interesting to actually, work out the different levels. And again, there is material around which is available. My ignorance on this is quite breathtaking. I really haven't gone into this in any way. But I know there are various books. There's a wonderful Sefer Yerushalayim by somebody called Vilnai. Vilnai is four volumes. I think it's been translated into English. I think he was one of the early mayors of Jerusalem. And he wrote this fabulous book, four volumes, of the history and the development. And he talks a lot about the Eretika, the old city, and the walls. And he will give you all the details that you would want to know. Vilnai is a very, very interesting Sefer. All right, so let's have a look at chapter 12, page 204, verse 27, and let's just deal a little bit with Chanukat Chomat Yerushalayim. And I was just saying, before we get to this, the feeling about Nehemiah, throw in a little thought for this week's parasha. It's a very difficult parasha to link to any of this, but there's a wonderful thought. I said it in a Shalashudas in Darche a few years ago. The idea of Ish. When it starts off, Adam ki yeh ba'o b'soro. It doesn't say Ish, it says Adam. It says a man who has in his skin, he has tzaras, right? And the Netziv asks the question, he says Adam is one of the highest levels of description of man, right? There's Adam, there's Ish, there's Gever, there's different words that are used. And Adam is usually used when you're talking about something very like, Adam Arishon was one of the highest creation, was the highest creation of God. So Adam, to use that when someone has got Saras is a strange combination. Someone is Adam and he's got Saras, what are you talking about? And the Tziv's question is answered by Nissen Alper. Nissen Alper, in his Sefer, I never knew him, but he must have been a very, very special man. I think that Abe, you did know. And he says, no, he says that the fact is that he uses the word Adam because it's significant. As far as I remember the thought, it's about the idea that, we believe in perfection. What we are, as a religion, we are about trying to gain perfection, all right? Trying to become a better person. So Adam is about the aspiration of the person to want to become improved. That's what the Pasuk says over there, Adam. That we're not looking at someone who is absolutely infallible. The non-Jews have infallibility and they have to deal with it. We don't. We have Adam, the idea of striving to be the best person you could possibly be, and that fits into what the person's trying to do. Tzaras, in fact, becomes for him a message from God that you've got to improve yourself. And when the person goes to the Kohen, that is his first step of improvement. He goes to the Kohen and he says, I want to be a better person. Adam, I want to try and improve myself. And then he has to go through that process. And I always felt that Adam here is a great description of Nehemiah. He is a person who is always not just trying to improve himself, but trying to improve the matzav, the lot of the Jewish people. He is absolutely determined that this Beit Sheni, and he knows all the drawbacks and the flaws and the limitations, but he is determined to make it as good as it possibly can be. And again, did he see it as messianic? And I think you have to say no. I think they realize that with everything that's going on here, it's not going to be the menucha nachala that they're waiting for, the final. But who knows? This, if it develops into something really strong and positive, then it could very well be that. But of course, it wasn't meant to be. When you look at the history of the Second Temple period, it becomes very challenging and very too much politics, and we've seen all that before. It's not a happy time once you get past the initial beginnings. Even the Hanukkah story is so full of intrigue and difficulty. So. It just was not quite the way it turned out. But listen to this, back to chapter 12. And again, I just wanted to say that about Nehemiah, because I think he's one of the unsung heroes of the Bible. I don't think people know about him. And he really is an important person. So, Kav Zayin, verse 27. after the listing of all the names that we had, b'chanukat chomat Yerushalayim. B'kshur et aleviyim, mikol makom atam. They want to bring the levim. It's almost as if he wants to be metaken olam. You know, he wants to repair what the fact that they hadn't come together initially to Yerushalayim the way they should have done. He's bringing them in now. L'haviyam Yerushalayim, nasot chanukah. They're going to have this fantastic celebration, the dedication, Chanukah. It's interesting, this is a reference, you know, the word is here. When you're looking for the reference of the word, not necessarily of the festival, but of the word in the Bible, here it is, because it's not very much in the Mishnah. All right, we know that the Chanukah was not dedicated, no Mishnahs were dedicated to Chanukah. The whole story of Chanukah is sort of snuck into the Gemara. And any sort of mention in the Mishnah is very, very limited indeed. Not about the festival. So there's a whole discussion about the Chasam Sofer. Talks about the fact that Rebbe was very upset about the festival of Chanukah. About the story of Chanukah, not the festival, but the story. Because it represented people trying to usurp the throne of the Malucha, the kingship, away from the tribe of Yehuda to the Kohanim. Because the Hasmoneans were all Kohanim. So the leadership struggle that developed because of the Chanukah story was something, good evening, that Rebbe was not, how should we say, he wasn't so excited about. Chasam Sofer talks about this, an interesting description he makes over there. Now here's the word Chanukah. So v'simcha b'todot b'shir, you're going to see that there's going to be a very special procession, going to be joyous and song, and todot literally means to give thanks or thanksgiving. You'll see there's actually going to be special korban todot they're going to have. Mitziltayim, nevalim, kinarot, bring out all the instruments that you could ever wish to play in those days. Cymbals, psalteries, and harps. Okay, I'm not sure what a psaltery is, but I guess it's some sort of a stringed instrument. That's what I guess. Chavchet, ve'yosu b'nei hamashorim, and they brought together all of the singers, the chazonim. These are the tenors and all the rest of them in Akikar, Sivod Yerushalayim. They all came from the valleys around, from the plains around Yerushalayim. Min chatzrei netofati, and from the villages surrounding. In other words, as we saw in the previous chapter, all these places were occupied, not only in Jerusalem, but around Jerusalem. There was a kind of areas which were made sure people living there as a buffer zone, as a protection of Yerushalayim. So now all of those people are being brought to Yerushalayim in order to celebrate this fantastic dedication. And it's wonderful to read this. Kavtet, Umi Beta Gilgal, Mistot Geva, Vaz Mavet, all these different places we actually mentioned previously, where the people went to live, they all came. Ki Achatzerim, Banu Lehem, Amashorim, Sivod Yerushalayim. They built for themselves courtyards, they built protective areas so that they could live near Yerushalayim, around Jerusalem. And of course, when you go today and you look at the archaeology, it's just so interesting how many mikvahs they find, places where people could be matayar, could purify themselves before they came to the Beit HaMikdash. It's phenomenal how all of this, you know, is really happening in front of our very eyes, being discovered on a daily basis. It's just worth following all the reports, all the archaeological reports, because they're just fascinating. So Laman, Vayitaro Kohanim Aleviim. Now there was a communal tahara. One assumes that this is, you know, linked to last week's parasha, Parashat Parah. There must have been a paraduma, but it doesn't actually say paraduma. So it could be that it was as much a tahara that they could do. They went to the mikveh, but I would like to think it was a bit more than that. Vayaleviim, but I don't know. The Farshim don't say if there was a paraduma here, and it doesn't say in the pasuk. Just Rashi says, "Tchila tira dasman v'achat tiru." So they tiarua should be with a head, yeah. And then they did themselves, and then everybody else. But he doesn't mention about a paraduma. So I don't know. One maybe. It may be without the paraduma. I mean, there's a whole discussion today. We mentioned this a number of times about how we would bring korbanot in the day that we are in, and even without a paraduma, there'd be certain allowances. Tumahutra b'tzibo, there's a rule that if the whole community is not able to become tahor, become ritually pure, they can do the korban in a state of tumah, in a state of impurity. And that would be the rule today, if we would possibly be allowed to do it. Chasam Sofer is a whole tshuva about it, and he said, yes, go ahead, but the Arabs weren't allowed to do it. And this was written, you know, sort of well over nearly 200 years ago, 170 years ago, and it hasn't changed very much since then. But one day, very soon, we've got Korban Pesach, another couple of weeks.
But we can't presume that everybody was coming Mace?
You just had that assumption.
Just like today.
Yeah, and also because they'd come back from Chutz La'aretz, and by going to Chutz La'aretz, you become Tomei anyway. All right, but I don't want to sort of say it too loud, but living Chutz La'aretz makes you automatically ritually impure. So even though, even going to the mikveh every day, which the Hasidim do, I'm not quite sure. I suppose it has some effect. But it's a nice, I suppose
that,
it's...
That tumah of being Chutz La'aretz, is that tumah's mace?
No, it's a special level of tumah. I don't think... Tumah's mace is at the top of the top of the tree. It gives you a status of tumah that you have to purify yourself to go, being either coming into Eretz Yisrael or whatever. I'm not sure exactly which level it's at, but it is pretty serious. So have a look at this. Lama. And then they started purifying the people, and then they went for the gates and for the walls. So one assumes they had some sort of process of purification. Very unclear what the process was. I tried to look here, even in the commentary here. One assumes that, he says, the Ralbach says the wall was made in such a way it's possible to walk atop it. In other words, maybe the purification of the wall was not as we would expect, some, you know, like some sort of ritual process. It was just using or being on the wall, walking on the wall. That made the wall tahor, that gave the wall a certain amount of purity. I'm not quite sure how to explain it, but there is a symbolic thing going on here. And Lamadalava Ale et Sare Yuda. And obviously the princes of Yehuda, they were going to be the leaders. They were taken to the on top of the wall. And there were two offerings which were up there, two thanksgiving offerings, right? The Todah, Mizmor LeTodah, we say every day. And there was a group that went off to the right. The Lashah Ashpot, to the gate of Ashpot, which the dung gate, which if any of these gates are similar to anything today, that's the one that we actually still have kept the name. And one assumes that's the gate when you come in on the right of the Kotel, that's the where all the taxes are and everything. You know, you wait over there, that's called the Lashah Ashpot. The other names of the different entrances of Yerushalayim here are different. And there's an article, if you're really sort of interested in trying to find out, the Dat Mikra has got a nice piece at the end where he tries to link up the names of what we see in Sefer Nehemiah and Sefer Ezra with the names of the different gates that we have today. All right, Shai Yafo, what is that the equivalent of in Sefer Ezra? And I don't remember now, but they're all different names that are coming up here. And he tries to sort of plot out the different gates of the original names. Lamed Bet. Vayelech Achreim Hoshaya V'chatzi Sarei Yehuda. And afterwards there was a gentleman called Hoshaya and half of the leaders of Yehuda, Vazaria, Ezra, Meshulam. Then we go into names again. All right, all the people that were in this procession, Yehuda, Binyamin, Shmaya, V'yemiyah, and these are all names which we recognize because they're, you know, names from posterity as well. And it's interesting, they brought the Chatzotzrot, which again, obviously refers back to the Chatzotzrot in the Torah, the trumpets that were blown on a happy occasion. And we had Zechariah, Ben Yonatan, Ben Shmaya, Ben Matanya, Ben Michio, Ben Zakur, Ben Asam, Be'echav, and then his brother Shemaiah ve'Azrael, Melalai, Gilalai, and it goes on, and Ma'ai, you know, you go through all these names. Just finish that posuk, Netanel, Yudah, Hanani, Becho, Bechlei, Shir, David, Isho, Elokim. And it seems that they had the instruments, that were they the original instruments of David? It's not clear, right? It may very well be that these were preserved. How they got preserved, I don't know. Because, you know, you always wonder about the Kalim, what happened. We know at the end of the Second Temple, you know, the Arch of Titus, you know, has a picture of all these things being taken out of Yerushalayim. So the question is, at this point, at the beginning of the Bayit Sheni, were these implements still accessible that they could use them? Or were they fashioned like the original Kalim, the Kleshir, the original instruments, the musical instruments of David? But I like the way it said, David Ish Elokim, the man of God, right? The Ezra Soplifnem, and Ezra was leading them. And again, the image here of leading the flock of the Jewish people, Ezra being the Moshe Rabbeinu character. There's a beautiful image here, you know, of the people walking around Yerushalayim, dedicating the areas they go along with this particular celebration of Todot, Korbanot, sacrifices, but at the same time also singing and tremendous simcha. And finally, Lamed Zayin, It's not fine, excuse me. Lamazaiva, Shah Ha'ayin, is a bit more to go here. V'negdam, they get to Shah Ha'ayin, the fountain gate. And again, where that actually is in terms of today, I'm not even sure if we, here in the commentary, doesn't even give us an idea. Seems they went from the fountain gate from the dung gate. So if they're going that way, this could very well be Shah Yafa. I don't know if they're going down out of Shah Shpot and they're going towards Shah Yafa. It could very well be. They're going, come out of Shah Shpot, the dung gate, you go to the right, you're in the direction of the Jaffa gate. So this is maybe a reference to the Jaffa gate, I don't know. But yeah, anyway, it says, Vashayin, the Negdam, Alu, El Malot, Ir David, they went from the steps coming up from Ir David. We know Ir David is down in the valley. They're coming up from the city of David. B'ma'ale l'chomal, coming up to the wall. Me'al le'beit David, from above the house of David. Shah ha'mayim ha'mizrach, and some sort of water gate. All right, now I don't want to mention that without sort of saying that, you know, we had Watergate before they did, but that's what I'm going to say about it. It's just a very interesting thing. Shar HaMayim Mizrach, on the east. There was an eastern side which was called Shar HaMayim, the Watergate. Batoda Sheinit HaLechet LeMoel, and there was a second offering which went in the sort of opposite direction. And Nehemiah is talking, he's describing this. The beautiful thing, for that, again, if you haven't heard the Shiurim of Nehemiah, it's worth just going over some of the stuff. The fact is, this is a very personal sefer. He is talking about his own, what he saw, his experience. Very, very unique. Very rare that we get a sefer written in this particular style, in the Ani, you know, talking about what I did. Okay, the Torah is usually not written like this. All right, there are accounts, but it's not written from such a very individual perspective. And this is what makes it particularly interesting and you know, worthy of study. So he says, "Vaniachra." Ezra says, "Nehemiah, I was behind that particular group going in that direction." V'chatzi ha'am me'al l'chuma me'al l'migdal ha'tanurim. There was half the group which was right above the tower of the ovens, whatever that is. Maybe that's what we nowadays call Migdal David, I don't know. V'yada chomar rechava, until the wall got a bit broader, wall got wider, a wider part of the wall. And lamated, and you're being taken on a walk, a virtual walk around Jerusalem. Now the real way to do this would be with a PowerPoint and, you know, the whole thing to show you as we're walking along, which part of the wall we're actually getting to. But as I said, it's a bit contentious. Not everyone agrees exactly which areas we're being referring to. So, you know, it's one of those things that you should look out for. If anyone presents this particular chapter with a PowerPoint, it'd be worth going to see. So, Me'al, Lamatet. Me'al Lashai Ephraim. We get above the gate of Ephraim, whatever that is. Me'ashah HaYishana, the old gate, Vashah Dagim, the fish gate, right? Migdal Chananel, Migdal Hameya, there were different towers. Some of these towers obviously don't exist anymore, apart from Migdal David. You know, we're not sure which towers we're referring to here. Me'at Shah Hatzon, there was a gate known as the gate of the flock, of the sheep. Me'am Debushah Matara, and they stood at the gate of the Matara, which is translated here as the guard. So there must have been some gate where the guards were, you know, sort of stationed or whatever. V'ta'amon Hashtei Atodot B'Beit Elokim, and these two offerings arrived at the house of God. And I was there with half of the skanim, those who appointed. Presumably, the word skan is usually used in reference to the kohanim, the kohanim who were deputies, right? Who would get involved? Memala v'kohanim, and who were they? Eliyokim, Maseiam, Inyamim, Michyam, Elionei, Vezcharia, Chananya, Bechatzotzrot. Again, they're blowing their trumpets. Umaseo, Shmaya, Veloza, Uzi, Yochanan, Milkiya, Ve'elam, Ozev, Yashmiya, Mesharim, Yizrachia, Hapakit. And there was a overseer, a guy called Yizrachia. Great names for those looking for unusual names if you want to name your kids something unusual, but I would say don't try it over here. Maybe save it for Israel. There are these names. You hear these names every so often in Israel, but not really over here. V'yizbuchu b'yamahuz v'achim gedolim, and it's a beautiful description. Many sacrifices on that day. V'yizbuchu, and they were so happy. Ki elokim simcham simcha gedola. And again, interesting. I've noticed, and this is a question I have, that it's not using the word yud kei vav kei. It's always elokim in this chapter. Right, Elohim is always this idea, Midat Adin, that they felt that, you know, God had really judged them, Midat Adin, in a positive sense. that they'd come through a tremendous test and they'd succeeded. Right? The word Elohim is used in the Akedah when Abraham is being tested by God. Okay? And again, maybe this is the theme. The idea is that they're doing something incredible over here, and with the blessing of Hashem, and particularly Midat Hadin, getting through this challenge of getting it right and getting it established and everything else, and the word Elohim reflects that. It's a suggestion. I don't know. There may be another reason, but that seemed to me the theme over here. And he says, not only are the men involved, this is a very important thing, but gam hanoshim vayelodim samech, the women and children are also there. This is not Simchas Torah with the women downstairs. This is everybody rejoicing. Yeah, sorry, yes.
Is this a problem because most of these women are not Jewish?
And who is rejoicing over here? And that's a good question. Yeah, one assumes that everybody joined in, but of course, are we talking about the Jews, the non-Jews? This is, again, your point is a very good point. But at this point, we're not sort of checking their tzitzis, but everyone is welcome to this party at the moment. And it says, "Vatishama simchad Yerushalayim merachok," and that's a fantastic thing, that the joy of Jerusalem was heard, merachok, of course, Yerushalayim being on top of the hill, then it just reverberated. I'll tell you a funny story. This happened when my brother-in-law got remarried 5 years ago, and we were in Israel for the wedding, and in Israel especially Yerushalayim, I don't know if you realize it when you're there, but it is actually not a city, it's a shtibl. The whole of the city is in fact a very big shul. Because what happens in the shul, as everybody knows, you know, eventually you go to shul long enough, you'll get to know sitting in that corner and this one and that one. You get to know everybody who's there. You get to know what their strengths, their weaknesses, who they are, what they're doing. We got into a cab the day after the wedding. And this is, the wedding was on where is it? Near Amon HaNetziv. There's something called the Tayele, a very beautiful area over there overlooking the old city. And we got into a cab in the center of Yerushalayim the next day. And of course, they, you know, hears your accent, the cab driver, so he wants to know where you're from. So we said, yeah, we're from the States, we came for the wedding. Ah, you came for the wedding. Which wedding did you come from? So we said, the one which was on Amon HaNetziv. He said, that wedding. He says, Kol Yerushalayim, Amad, but Tehom. You know, they all stood amazed, because apparently what had happened, I didn't realize this, that they'd set up fireworks at the wedding, and all the cabbies stopped. Just to see what was going on. There was a firework display going on the hill. And they all knew about this wedding. So here you are in Yerushalayim, talking to someone you never met in your life about the wedding you've just come to attend. And this is Jerusalem. You know, it's like today, there's a thing on YouTube, there was a traffic jam, there's a Braslav Achosi dancing there. He's got a loud radio, and he's dancing some, whatever it is, and the guy gets out of the car and joins him. And in the middle of middle of the highway, you know, when everybody is getting very, very gekochen, you know, they're getting upset about it. No, these two guys are dancing, they seem to be very happy. You know, as they commented when he got back in the car, only in Israel. Any place, if you start dancing in the middle of the New Jersey Turnpike, they will send some very serious guys to cart you away as soon as possible. It just amazed me. It's really something to see. So again, Tishma Simchat Yerushalayim Erechot. You know, this is what reminds me, this is the thought that goes through my mind. That even from a distance, you know, every simcha, every joy is intensified in Yerushalayim. It's a very, very special place. Mem Dalet, so listen to this. Vayipokdu bayom ahu anashim al anshachot. And what, of course, on that day, they began to appoint the various people on different offices. And it's interesting, the word nishachot is really translated as the Hebrew word lishachot, lishchat, lishchat agazid, right? There's a famous expression. But it's called nishachot. And I think there's a purposeful change, because noshach means to bite, right? Some of these offices, unfortunately, are going to bite you, right? You've got the tax office, there's no way to describe it, except to say it's going to be noshech, it's going to bite you. But it's actually referring to the offices, to the people running these different departments. The civil service, you know, the pakid. In Israel, you've got to have pakidim, otherwise you can't have a country. So this is what happened in those days. It had men appointing al anashachot over these particular offices. What were they doing there? Lot sarot, the trumot, looking after the stores and the trumot, all the different donations, or some say this is actually the truma, which was separated the various offerings of the reshit and the first offerings. That's the bikurim, ul masrot, and all the masrot, the tithes, lichnos behem listei ha'arim and ha'ot ha'torah, and they would then bring various portions which the Torah demands from all the different cities, and the Kohanim, the Levim, and they have to have a place to store it. The Kohanim are getting their Truma, the Levim are getting their Maisa. There is a place where all of this stuff is being stored. Ki Simchat Yehuda Ala Kohanim Alevim Omdim. There was a tremendous joy in Yehuda, meaning outside Yerushalayim, people were beginning to get into the swing of what Jewish life was always about. The idea of centrality of Yerushalayim, of the city, and of the Beit HaMikdash, and bringing their support, their financial support, through these offerings to these various people. Yeah. Yeah. And also that's the Ezanesha. No sashich, that ribis can bite. Demand. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. But what exactly the officers were doing, we're not really told, but one can guess. But I like the fact he calls it nishacho, not lishacho. Okay, he changes the lama to a nun. Vayishmu mishmeret Eloheim, mishmeret Haran. And this again, as I said, this is Adam. This is aiming for 100%. And therefore they want to guard the guarding of God, meaning, of course, you know, is making sure that everything is done properly in Yerushalayim, in the Beit HaMikdash, and Mishmeret HaTahara, to keep the order of Tahara. When Mashiach comes, that's going to be one of the biggest changes in our lives. If the order of Tahara comes back the way it was, you know, you read Gemara, you realize how Tahara affected their lives. That the whole idea of ritual purity, something that we just do not remotely connect to Bizman HaZeh. Again, we do try. I mean, obviously, we have laws of Nida, and we have, Mikvah for Rosh Hashanah. You know, we try to have some sense of it, but the day-to-day concept of Al Taras HaKodesh, as the Gemara calls it, that's something which was very distant from us. And this again, here is being revived, being renewed, and with a great simcha. So initially, this was something special. And it says, Vamashorim, the end of verse 45, Vamashorim, Vashorim, Kmisvat David, Shlomo Bano. And this is all according to the mitzvah, the commandment of David, and the Vav is missing here, and Shlomo his son, meaning that as they established it in the beginning of the first temple, now we are establishing all of this pomp and circumstance, you want to call it that, at the beginning of the second temple. And explains, in the days of David and Asaf, we have Mizmoli Asaf. Okay, he's a gentleman we don't know much about, but he's mentioned in Tehillim, and he's mentioned here. In those days, Rashei Mishorim, Vashir Tehillah, Vodod Leluhim, there was a tremendous sense of praising of God, you know, on a constant basis. V'chol Yisrael b'imei Zerubbabel b'imei Nehemiah, and Nodnim and Ayota Mashorim Vashorim, and people started giving their portions the way they had to. Devayom biyomo, every single day. Umakdishim laLeviim vaLeviim makdishim leBnei Aaron, and the tenth went to the Levi, and then the Levi had to give his portion to the Bnei Aaron, and so the whole procedure, the whole process began. And chapter 13, which is the climax of this Sefer, is again, whenever they seem to be spiritually elevated, they immediately turn to the Torah. And there's a reason for this. For 70 years, they were without. You know, the Galut, the only thing I can compare it to is what the Jews went through in Russia. When the Jews lived through communism in Russia, it wasn't that they were oppressed, it was that they were minus every connection, particularly towards, you know, after World War II, when they really, anyone who was remotely religious had been killed or moved away, managed to get away, but the people left behind, their sense of identity was very strong, but their sense of knowledge was zero. And this again sort of reminds me of all of this, that to come now out of the darkness, out of that 70 years, they are being encouraged immediately to relate to the Torah, to open it up again, and to see what's going on. And listen to this, and here they get a very interesting lesson. I'm just going to start a little bit of chapter 13. Bayom ahu nikra b'sefer Moshe b'znei ha'am. They started reading the book of Moshe. V'nimsa katubo asher le'yavam ani amo'avi b'kal alim ad olam. And again, they came across the same issue which has always been bugging them from the moment they returned, which is the concept of being married to outsiders. And we're going to have an interesting development in this story. Just to pedal back to the first chapter, Nehemiah, we know, was very high up in the Persian government, essentially. And he was allowed by the king Artaxerxes to come and establish the walls of Yerushalayim. He asked for a reprieve from his job, and he was allowed to go. And what we're going to see here is that he made a promise then to go back. And he made a promise to go back to tell, I presume to give him an update of what's going on, and to explain. And it says that at this point, we're going to see in chapter 13, he's actually out of Eretz Israel for a period of time, having gone back to the Persian leaders that he was connected to give them the update of what happened. And during that period of time, there was one person, an Ammonite, a man that we've come across before called Tuvia, Tovia his name was, and he decided that he was going to take advantage of all of this money flowing into the Beit HaMikdash, flowing into Yerushalayim, and he had the right connections, and he managed to establish himself in one of those offices, in one of the Neshachot that we mentioned here. He actually established his home there. He had a little sort of bedsit. I don't know what you call them here. A bachelor pad. I don't know how you describe it. Some sort of flat, some sort of apartment, which was in the confine of the temple. And stuff that would come in, he would hive off a little bit for himself. So he was doing great. He was doing fantastically well for himself, but of course, totally forbidden. So Nehemiah, while he was away, you'll see this whole story, Nehemiah has to deal with this particular gentleman, Tovia, and it shows Nehemiah's ability, his power. Again, Adam. Adam is the guy who wants to aim for 100. He wants to get up there. He knows he may not achieve 100. He may only get to 50 or 60. But if you only aim for 60, you end up with 30. He's aiming for 100. And because he's aiming for 100, you'll see he comes across this little element of corruption and he deals with it. He deals essentially now in the last chapter with, again, the issue of intermarriage, which doesn't stop, doesn't get cured overnight, as we know to this very day. And the second issue which he's going to deal with here, which is fascinating, is, as we explained, the issue of Shabbos. And that's something which we'll talk about, Mitzvah Shem, I hope, next week. I want to just finish the chapter first and then give you a bit of background. There is a very, very fascinating analysis of what exactly Nehemiah did in order to preserve the law and the sense, the kedusha, the holiness of Shabbos. And you'll see what he did, and very, very interesting. Not so much even mentioned in the Psukim, but certainly mentioned in the Gemara. So, but just a few more Psukim here. Pasuk Bet, Ki lo kidmuet b'nei so belechem b'mayim. We're going to give a bit of history why we don't like the Ammonites and the Moabites, because they didn't feed us, right? With bread and water. Vayiskor alav et Bilam, the Kalon. They actually invited Bilam. They hired him to curse us. This is a bit of history. And whenever they can refer back to ancient history, they always do. Vayaboch Eloheinu HaKlala Levracha, and God turned the curse into a blessing. So that's the potted version of the story of Bilam, according to the book of Nehemiah. Vayihi kashamam et haTorah, and as soon as the people heard the Torah, and they were overwhelmed by what they were hearing, vayavdilu kol erev Yisrael, immediately again there was a separation. As we had at the beginning with Ezra, now with Nehemiah, same situation, that the mixed marriages, the women, if we're not Jewish, they were set aside, and maybe the men equally if they weren't Jewish, and these non-Jewish partners were essentially sent away. Well, if name is there, Eliyashiva Kohen Natum Belishchat Beit Eloheinu Karov LeTuvia, and now we're going to just mention this story with Tuvia, that we had a gentleman who had his office in the temple called Eliyashiv. And he was Karov, he was very close to Tuvia, some sort of kinsman, not necessarily relative, but he was certainly one of his pals. Vayas lo lishcha gedola, he made an office for him, for Tuvia. Vashama yu lefanim, notnim et amincha levona, it's where they kept the levona, which was the frankincense, very expensive. Vakelim, vamasa, dagan, and all the tithes of corn and tirosh, itzan, the oil and the wine, and mitzvat alviim, as commanded to Levim, Ashorim, and the gatekeep, all of these people, all their various offerings were kept. Part of it was kept in this office of Tovia, Trumata Kohanim, and all the offerings. And what happened? Ubechol ze lo ayiti v'shalayim. Says Nehemiah again, he says, I wasn't in Jerusalem during this period. Ki bishnat shloshim v'shtayim latachshasta. Melech Bavel, I was still... I had to go back to Artaxerxes in his 32nd year of his reign. Bati el HaMelech, I went back to the king to fulfill his promise. Ulekeitz Yamim, Nishalti Min HaMelech, And at the end, after some days, I asked permission to go back to Yerushalayim. Va'avol Yerushalayim, va'avina bra. I returned, and then I realized there's something very bad going on here. Asher asal yashiv le'toviyah, which Eliyashiv had made for Toviyah, la'asod lo nishcha, back to the word nishcha, as opposed to lishcha, it became something which was biting. It was an office which unfortunately took too much of a bite out of these offerings in the wrong sense. It was stealing them. But chatzrei beit elokim, in the courtyard of God, in the house of God, ve'yirali ma'od, it was very bad to me. So what did I do? Vashlicha et kol klei beit toviyah chutz min alishcha. Just threw out everything from that office. I didn't kill him. I didn't do anything violent towards toviyah. I just made it very clear that this was not accepted when I took all the kelim and threw them out. And we just finished on this pasuk. V'yomra v'itara l'shchod, and I told them to purify this area all over again. V'ashiva sham klei beit elokim, and I put back the vessels of the house of God. Et mincha alavona. And basically what happened was that this is where Toviyah decides not really very safe for me to stay around. Nehemiah is doing a clean up here and I have to get out of here, and he runs away. Very, very fascinating. And what we'll see, as I said, next week, Bezrat Hashem, in the finish, is to see exactly the final takanot, the final rules and regulations that Nehemiah made, and to have a bit of a deeper awareness, particularly about the laws of Mukta, which Nehemiah seems to have reformatted, recreated, re-established, right? And to try and understand what exactly Nehemiah did. Was the law of Mukta, and this is the question of the week, if Nehemiah established the laws of Mukta from scratch, was it his invention, which seems to be one of the suggestions of the Gemara, or was it something that originally did exist, and was re-established by Nehemiah in stages, as you'll see, and what was the logic of it. And in fact, if you think about it, Muktzah is one of the greatest ways that we have of reminding ourselves about Shabbos. Muktzah is not about not touching something, it's about moving. All right, tiltu. Muktzah is never about touching, it's about moving. The idea is that before you move something on Shabbos, you've just got to think twice, is this within the framework of Shabbos that I can move it, or is it outside the framework that I cannot move it? So Ezra will see, Nehemiah talks about a big hammer, and he talks about other things which they would use, sometimes for building, sometimes for eating purposes, cracking nuts or whatever, and we'll see next week, Bezrat Hashem, what Nehemiah decides to do. Very controversial, as always, and very exciting. To be finished, Bezrat Hashem, next week, let's see him. So I'm really looking forward, and Sefer Nehemiah is very inspiring. I don't know about you guys, but I'm inspired. I hope you are as well.
Why do you think it's not very popular?
Nehemiah? I don't know.
I mean, there's so many other names, remote names
I know. And it's one of the names of Mashiach. According to the Slichas,
rarely,
we say Menachem and Nehemiah. And
rarely do you find Nehemiah.
My grandfather was Nehemiah. My grandfather was Nehemiah. My brother's named after my grandfather, Nehemiah. But it's not as popular. Yeah. The old joke, he was very short because he was knee-high Meyer.
Oh.
That was the old joke, but that's an old vaudeville joke. Yeah, sorry. same guy as Rubavel. Yeah, same gentleman. That's a name that's definitely not used anymore. Before Nehemiah, he was right at the beginning of the return, more toward, even before Ezra. This is going right back into the early days of Cyrus, and that brought the first wave, the first Aliyah, if you want to call it that. To be continued, Bezrat Hashem, thank everybody, and we look forward next week. Please God.